above around 400 or 500 metres. Western Scotland will see fewer showers with some sunny spells here. An easterly wind, though, will develop and it will feel quite chilly for most with highs of 5 to 7. On Wednesday night, the showers will gradually ease off. It'll turn very cold with a warning of icy conditions on Wednesday night into Thursday morning. So for Thursday, very cold with an easterly wind. And then, as I said, Friday is back to wet and windy again. And that's your weather.
Elizabeth, thank you. Now on Radio 4 White Beach, Jermaine Greer has been searching for a piece of land to heal, preferably desert, a project to work on in her native Australia with her botanist sister. But after 2 years of searching, she's drawn a blank. But then she gives a lecture near Brisbane and someone mentions Ken's mother's place.
Ken and his wife Jane Francis offered to drive me to the property. I had hoped it was out to the west, in the Darling Downs perhaps, but they turned south, down the Pacific Highway towards the Gold Coast. My heart sank. At Narang, we left the highway, crossed the river, and headed southwest through the suburbs towards the hinterland. The valley of the Upper Narang River is known by its Aboriginal name as the Numinbar Valley. We crossed it by the new Pine Creek Bridge, with not a hoop pine to be seen, and entered the Numinbar State Forest, a sign by the Environmental Education Centre, featuring sweet-faced forest fauna, asked us not to litter the valley. The locals are watching you. There was a loop of river on our right. Ken explained, this is where the kids used to go for the big splash of a big old river gum, but that's gone now. The Shire Council took the place over in the 70s and schmicked it up with toilets and barbecues and garbage bins and called it Boko Park. The air was growing humid. On the roadside, only the camphor laurels stood proud and unencumbered, wrapped in their own toxic vapours, while the native trees suffocated under curtains of balloon vine and morning glory. Around and between them, jacarandas, coral trees and cocos palms vied with every kind of gaudy suburban garden escapee. Everybody loves jacarandas, which flower in violet-blue panicles on their bare branches. When the jacaranda was introduced, the gardening correspondent of the Sydney Morning Herald waxed lyrical in its praise. This most beautiful flowering tree is a native of Brazil. In Queensland, the curator of the Brisbane City Botanical Gardens was the first to show a specimen at the Horticultural and Agricultural Society exhibition in 1865. The jacaranda he showed was described as a shrub. Over the years, it would have grown to about 30 metres in height and produced copious quantities of seed. 150 years later, Queensland has woken up to the fact that it's an invasive species. In the same show, the curator also presented four specimens of the coral tree, which has a large, drooping red flower shaped something like a fuchsia. The specimens shown were almost certainly examples of the South American Cockspur coral tree, which has also become a serious weed of Australia's rainforest. Even after it's been poisoned and is apparently dead, the fallen branches are capable of rooting and regeneration. The pattern was early set. Australian nurserymen wouldn't bother to propagate or improve local species, but would import specimens of exotic species. Anyone who didn't plant a coral tree and a jacaranda in the front garden was deemed insensible to beauty. Native ground covers were weeds by definition, and were uprooted and burnt to be replaced by long avenues of agapanthus. Australian gardens are still full of them, as well as thousands of other exotics, many of which have serious weed potential. Gladioli, daisies, lilies, honeysuckles, vincas and morning glories are declared weeds already. Not so long ago, I was as insensitive to the beauty of Australian native vegetation as anyone else. As a child, I longed for the flowers that starred the alpine meadows where Heidi grew up, for edelweiss and gentians. In coastal Victoria, the only daisies I had to make chains with
weren't silver white with golden centres, but dull yellow with dirty grey disc florets. I studied European wildflowers for years before I paid any attention to the wildflowers of the Great South Land. If I look for my Eureka moment, it seems to be a TV programme on Australian flora presented by David Bellamy. Nobody had ever explained to me why Australian flowers were the way they were and how fascinating their difference was. Bellamy projected his wonder and intellectual excitement, and by the time the credits rolled, I'd stopped wishing Australian blooms were like flowers in manuscript illuminations and Dutch painting, and I was ready to give them my full attention. I didn't fall in love with native Australian vegetation until I was middle-aged, and then I fell hard, as middle-aged women do. As the road crossed the river and followed its left bank high into the hills, I began to notice that the canopy trees in the native woodland had changed into big specimens of brush box, flooded gum, tallowwood, and turpentine. Then I understood. The eucalypts I was looking at weren't virgin forest, but regrowth. Before white settlement, this part of the valley must have been clothed in rainforest. Ever since it had been cleared, it had been colonised by pioneer myrtaceous species that grow much faster than the original vegetation, which was and is still struggling to reclaim its territory. The struggle is hopeless because the sclerophylls regularly burn, either spontaneously or because of deliberate backburning. They survive the conflagration, but the rainforest saplings don't. What I was seeing was a practical demonstration of how it was that the rainforest that once clothed Australia was corralled and driven back by the collaboration of eucalypts and fire until it was no more than a chain of remnants down the east coast of the continent. There wasn't much to like about the regrowth forest. In the cleared areas, the cattle looked hot and cross, and the horses were wearing masks and capes to protect them from the stinging flies. The road climbed out of the river valley, crossing a rocky creek making its way to the Narang River. The name on the sign was Cave Creek. As we turned left into the entrance of the Natural Arch section of the Springbrook National Park, everything changed. Massive water vines curtained the road. Huge pea pods and strings of nuts hung in the trees. Tree ferns and palms patterned the understory. A black brush turkey with bald red head, chrome-yellow cravat, and a tail attached vertically instead of horizontally, fled at our approach. The narrow road divided and then turned into a car park, which was full of people, most of them in bathers. A sign said, "Thieves are active in this car park. Do not leave valuables in the car." So much for tranquility. "What's going on here?" I asked. "They've come to see the natural arch." "A rock formation," I scoffed. "Australians are the only people in the world who'll drive for hundreds of kilometres just to see a funny-looking rock." We kept driving through the car park, past the toilets and the information kiosk, athwart a steep slope between rainforest on the upper side and a dense stand of hoop pines on the lower, through an open gate and several acres of lantana. "This is it," said Ken, as we crossed a concrete causeway over a creek full of mistweed and busy Lizzie. We kept going, past a single-story house sagging on slanting piles, to a gate and open fields. Beyond stood rather surprised cattle, hocked deep in lush kikuyu grass. Once out of the car, I could see that the property nestled within a half hoop of bare weathered scarps cropping out above the forest that foamed up in deep green waves from the cleared area where we stood. The effect was spectacular. We walked past the house and on, past muster yards and a milking parlour, up the main track, past blackwoods and silky oaks. Ken pointed out the course of the creek below us and the tributaries coming down from above. I felt blank, bewildered. Rainforest. I'd never thought of rainforest. 150 acres, Ken was saying. We bought it for my mother. We were hoping we could make money from it, but in the end we've just got to get the capital back. It's been on the market for a while, but there's been no interest. I said nothing. I felt nothing. Beyond a twinge of embarrassment, I was rehearsing how to tell these two good people that, after all their trouble, I wasn't interested either. Ken thought it might be nice to walk down to the creek. He walked across a paddock and into a stand of rainforest. I stepped after him into the forest twilight. Something invisible clawed at my cheek and hung on. Lawyer vine, said Ken. There's a lot of it in here. Look out. See that thing on your left? Don't touch it. It's a shiny stinger. This was definitely not my cup of tea. A closed forest, steep rocky ground, and malicious plant life to boot. And we hadn't even got to the snakes and spiders yet. Jane Frances suggested that we go to Angela's for lunch. It was a colonial-style pseudo-farmhouse with a curving drive bordered with agapanthus, shaded by the usual partnership of coral trees and jacarandas. According to her signage, Angela sold hot pies in inverted commas, snacks and craft. Jane Frances introduced me as Germaine. I hope you're nothing to do with that bloody Germaine Greer, said Angela, as she led us between shelves laden with handmade forgettabilia. On the ride back, we didn't talk about the property. I said I'd be in touch. On impulse, I decided to rent a car to drive back to Sydney. I wheeled it out onto the highway and raced back the way I'd come. If I'd calculated correctly, I'd be back at Natural Arch before sunset. I felt that I owed it to Ken and Jane Frances to give the property another chance. In the hot middle of the day, the Australian bush is silent. To understand the place, I had to see it when it was coming alive, when the indigo mists well up from the gullies. I parked the car under the jacaranda and walked up the track between tall stands of feral verbena and wild cotton. The cooling air was full of monarch butterflies. I turned off the track and struggled over rocks hidden by the long grass down towards the creek. Tiny jewelled birds were bouncing about in the lantana. Big brown pigeons were gorging on the fruits of wild tobacco. I perched on one of the biggest of the rocks and contemplated the forest edge. $500,000 for a rundown dairy farm? I didn't think so. Out from the clumps of native raspberry at the forest edge stepped a bird, a sort of crow in fancy dress. He was clad in a tabard of a yellow so intense that it seemed to burn, and a cap of the same yellow with a frosting of red on the crown. He walked up to within a few feet of me, fixed me with his round yellow eye, and began to move his black rump rhythmically back and forth. There was no doubt about it. He was dancing. What do you want with me, Birdie? More dancing, a little faster, if anything. Birdie, I have to go, or I'll be caught here in the dark. The black and gold bird made a little bow and disappeared among the raspberries. As I came inside of the house, the tenant was leaning on the veranda rail. I said, hi. What I thought was, sorry, mate, I'm gonna buy your house.
Germaine Greer has been reading from White Beach. The programme was abridged and produced by Jane Marshall Productions. Thank you. This is BBC Radio 4. Now time for the shipping forecast issued by the Met Office on behalf of the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency at 0015 on today, Wednesday the 29th of January. There are warnings of gales in Viking, North Utsira, South Utsira, Forties, Cromarty, Forth, Tyne, Dogger, Fisher, Jermyn Bight, Biscay, Trafalgar, Fitzroy, Sole, Lundy, Fastnet, Shannon, Rockall, Fair Isle and Faroes.